injured in a shooting operation in the West Bank as tensions remain high in the occupied territories. The Israeli military says Palestinian gunmen opened fire on a military bus. Six troops and the bus driver were injured. One of the troops is in serious condition. The incident took place on a major highway in the Jordan Valley near the Israeli settlement of Hamra. Israeli forces have arrested two people, but a manhunt continues for others potentially involved. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed, quote, the heroic retaliatory operation. The Gaza-based movement says the operation is in response to Israeli crimes and aggression against Al-Aqsa Mosque and Palestinian inmates. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to tell us more about this and any new developments. Said Nimr is a professor of political science at Brzezet University, also joining us from occupied Ramallah for an analysis. Well, Mona, at this point, we just said that a manhunt is underway. Tell us what you have for us on this news story.
Well, it seems, according to the Israeli military, that Israeli soldiers have arrested two Palestinians whom the Israeli military accuses that they are responsible for the shooting that took place at an Israeli bus in the Jordan Valley, Mohammed and Walid Turkman, and it seems that they are brothers from Jenin area. This is according to a statement from the Israeli military. What happened several hours ago is that Palestinians were inside a truck and they opened fire at a bus, wounding at least seven Israelis, including six Israeli soldiers. Two of them are in serious condition. And then they tried, according, of course, to the Israeli military we are speaking, those Palestinians tried to put the bus on fire and to burn it. They escaped. The Israeli soldiers searched for them and arrested the two Palestinians. This operation took place near the illegal settlement of Al-Hamra. It's also took place near the Palestinian village of Al-Atuf and Al-Bqi'a field there. This is what we have up to the moment. The Israeli military is also saying that they think there are more Palestinians took part in this operation. At least a third Palestinian was with those two who were detained and responsible for the shooting.
Said Nim, when you take a look at this news story, somebody from the outside, perhaps not familiar with the Palestinian issue and occupation and anything related to the Israeli regime and the way that it practices apartheid, they would say, you know, there's a bunch of terrorists out there who are doing this. But really, looking deeper inside the story, we know that that is just not the case. Even though we're not promoting violence, but when you have this type of operation take place, it's because of the oppression that Israel has exercised on Palestinians for decades, really. And therefore, these types of incidents are a result of that. What can be done in order for the world to see that through that lens instead of the lens of Western media, for example, who reported as a bunch of thugs, maybe Palestinians, who are just going after violence this way?
Yes, when it comes to the international media and the foreign media, generally speaking, they don't like to see what is obvious in front of them, and they want to see whatever they think they want to see. That's the problem. They don't see a whole city, a country of terrorism, and they focus on the Palestinian. If we look at the last few months since the beginning of this year, how many Palestinians were killed, how many Palestinians were injured, including what happened in Gaza and in the occupied territories, especially in the West Bank. The Israeli escalating their atrocities against the Palestinians since the beginning of this year in a very high record. This last month, we are talking about August, we recorded more than 700 attacks by the Israelis and by the settlers in the West Bank. So what do the Israeli and this hypocrite world media would like us to do, or to what should we do? If we resist, and this is our right, and this is our fully legal right to resist the occupation, then they will call us terrorists. Okay, if they want to call us terrorists, let them tell that we are terrorists. But at the same time, we have to defend ourselves and we have to react to the Israeli atrocities, because the Israelis, they don't understand but one language, which is violence versus violence. In the case of violence, then they will be more cautious and they will be more even thinking about whatever they are doing in the West Bank. But once there is no reaction at all and nobody is doing anything, definitely they will escalate and more escalation of their atrocities against Al-Aqsa Mosque, against Jerusalem, and against the rest of the occupied West Bank. So definitely this is a kind of a natural reaction by the Palestinians resist this occupation. Plus, what are these soldiers doing in our land? They are occupiers, and definitely, by definition, then we have the right to defend our land and to resist these soldiers and these occupiers in any way we find it appropriate. So definitely, our reaction, or the Palestinian reaction, is absolutely not only in place, but I would say also it was a little bit too late. We need even more than that. In the last few weeks, the Israeli recorded more than 16 attacks by the Palestinians against Israeli troops and against settlers. And I think that this is the only language that the Israeli could understand. We hope that the whole situation will be escalating, not only in Jenin and Nablus as it's going on today, but to be in all Palestinian cities under occupation, Ramallah, Qalqilia, Tulkarem, and Hebron, and Beit Lahem. Every city in the West Bank should resist this occupation, and it's not normal that the occupation will feel free in our country, occupying our country, and there will be no resistance. They should expect a resistance in every bend and in every road they might, you know, go into. So we think that things are escalating, and if we notice from the beginning of this year onward, started with Jenin, now it's on Nablus, and we hope that the rest of the cities will be the same. And this is the normal situation to resist this occupation, to defend our people, while at the same time the atrocities by the Israeli settlers and the Israeli army and police is also in going really in high records, especially in the last few months. So we do need to react to these kind of actions.
Thank you very much for that. Saad Nim, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University. We'd also like to thank Mona Kandil, a correspondent from occupied Ramallah. Thank you. Okay, moving on, the energy crisis in Europe is snowballing as nations across the continent continue to grapple with rising costs and supply shortages ahead of the cold season. Sweden is planning to offer liquidity guarantees worth billions of dollars to Nordic and Baltic energy companies to help them avert financial crisis. Sweden's prime minister says the country could be facing what she calls a war winter. Meanwhile, in the Czech Republic's capital Prague, tens of thousands of people have staged a protest, calling on the government to step in to tame energy prices. Protesters want their country to be neutral militarily and to enter into direct contracts with gas suppliers, including Russia. Energy prices are growing in the Czech Republic and other European countries following a drop in gas supplies from Russia. Sweden is not the only country trying to cushion the blow from the energy crisis in Europe. Germany also is working on measures of its own. The German government has approved the 65 billion euro inflation relief package to ease pressure on households as Russian gas supplies are dwindling and energy bills soaring. Berlin says timely and proportionate relief is necessary for citizens and businesses so that they can cope with the high energy costs. Germany is bracing for a shortage of supply as well, since Russia shut down the Nord Stream pipeline a few days ago, citing repairs and technical problems. Germany's network regulator is giving assurances that for now there is a sufficient supply, but says the situation is fluid and could worsen rapidly. Italy's football league Serie A says it will put a four-hour limit on the use of floodlights in stadiums on match days. It says the measure aims to cut energy use as prices have gone up. It comes as the government in Rome is in talks to adopt energy-saving measures ahead of the winter. Max Cibilli has more.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine. Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S.'s history of occupation and intervention in Latin America spans almost 200 years. The U.S. has been present in countries from the north of the continent in one form or another to achieve its own goals. But now the latest U.S. attempts to intervene in Cuba's affairs have drawn a backlash from officials there.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban Spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices, as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo. It's a State Department memo that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has made a blistering attack on his successor Joe Biden during an address to his supporters at a rally in Pennsylvania.
He's an enemy of the state. You want to know the truth? The enemy of the state is him and the group that control him, which is circling around him. Do this, do that, Joe. You're going to do this, Joe, right?
Trump was speaking 2 days after Biden delivered a speech accusing him and his Republican supporters of destroying American democracy. Trump said that Biden has given the most vicious, hateful, and divisive speech ever delivered by an American president. He also condemned last month's FBI raid of his Florida home as shameful and a travesty of justice. FBI agents found over 10,000 stolen, non-classified government documents spread across 27 boxes when they searched Trump's home and office. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
So we were just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit, with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just
but
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size their shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless. So.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters, police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality on Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shooter situation, some terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians. But never, ever, they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and the next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow, to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this would still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
When your horse returns to Alcamp Riderless.
أزور سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجاي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة مني ونيابة عن والدي.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves, Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of Ziyaratu Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Ziyaratu al-Ashura. So stay with us.
وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ آلَ زِيَادٍ وَآلَ مَرْوَانٍ.
Dear listeners, we were discussing this part of Ziyaratu al-Ashura. وَلَعَنَ اللَّهُ آلَ زِيَادٍ وَآلَ مَرْوَانٍ. May Allah distance from His mercy the clan of Ziyad and the clan of Marwan. We translated the word al, which appears twice in this verse, as a tribe and clan, and that is the collection of people having common attributes, in this case, common ancestors or common fraternity, etc. And in order to get to know the true meaning of al-Ziyad and al-Marwan, we had to first introduce who Ziyad and who Marwan is. We introduced Ziyad a little bit in the previous episode. He is called usually in history records as Ziyad ibn Abi, this Ziyad the son of his father, and also ibn Sumayya, Ziyad ibn Sumayya by the name of his mother. This Ziyad is also the first one to openly announce and begin vilification of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the cities of Basra and Kufa. Anyway, we came to understand earlier that Al refers to a number of people whose lineage or title or path or religion returns to one person, and that is why it is next to him. So all those who were united with the path of Ziyad, or who are still in the path of Ziyad, those all bear the same spirit of hatred against the Ahlul Bayt. And these are the ones from his all, and hence worthy of being cursed and being called upon, لَعْنَ اللَّهُ آلَ زِيَادٍ لَعْنَ اللَّهُ آلَ مَرْوَانٍ. So time or place cannot limit the true meaning of this part of Ziyaratul Ashura, neither they can limit the Al of Ziyad, because Al of Ziyad does not necessarily mean that the ones who are from his origin. Anyone who believes in his path and who claims to believe in that path and what he did in the history, those are all deserving to be called لَعَنَ اللَّهُ أَلَى زِيَادٍ. They are all within this al. So if, therefore, one observes that a particular ruler in the contemporary world adopts a path similar to that of Ziyad, he must not doubt that he is from Al of Ziyad. That is the true meaning of this لَعْنَ اللَّهُ أَلَى زِيَادٍ.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates him, he understands his dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we're talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So, in this episode, we came to understand Al Ziyad in a more profound way. Al Ziyad is not just those who have the common lineage, also the ones who have the common religion and belief can be called Al-Ziyad. And the equation is quite simple. The human being, as we came to understand in the previous episodes as we discussed, is tantamount to his thoughts and beliefs, what he likes and what he dislikes, his words and deeds. So if anyone claims to be an Islamic leader of a certain part of the Muslim world, but carries out atrocities against the lovers of Ahlul Bayt, just exactly as did the likes of Ziyad throughout the history, he is the embodiment, he is the manifestation of Ziyad, and therefore, from among Al-Ziyad he is. If you are familiar with the history books, with what history tells us, Salah ad-Din Ayyubi, as history reveals, is one of the examples of characters of Ziyad, I assume. During his time, he is reported to have killed many Shias. among the things he did against the Shias is the fact that he usurped the wealth, property, the houses of Fatimiyun, the Shias who used to live in Egypt and North Africa, and he gave their wealth to his people and tribe. He was the one who removed Shi'i judges and replaced them with other ones. He removed Hayya ala khayr al-amal from the call to prayer, or what we know as adhan. He prohibited the Shia school of thought and made Maliki and Shafi'i schools of thought to prevail. And he didn't stop there. He would spill the blood of those who refused to accept the schools of thought he believed in. He imprisoned the children of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Egypt. He separated between their men and women so that Imam's progeny becomes extinct. Sheikh Muhammad Jawad Mughniyeh, in his book called Shia wal Hakimun, says, he, Salahuddin, imprisoned the remaining Al-Alawiyun, the descendants of Imam Ali alayhi salam, in Egypt. He separated their men from their women so that they would not procreate. And these are only parts of what he did based on what history reveals. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عين لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين
بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين بالروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hamas hails as heroic a shooting operation in the West Bank that injured several Israeli soldiers, calling the move a natural response to the regime's crimes and aggression. Sweden's prime minister says the country could be facing a war winter as European nations grapple with an energy crisis. Plus, the German government announces yet another economic package as part of its measures to tackle soaring inflation.